Welcome to the Full of Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 12:48 p.m. that is Pacific Summer Time. Today is August 20th, and back in action following the long flight home from China. And despite feeling a little jet lagged, happy to be back in my desk in Los Angeles. When we look at markets today, Hong Kong has been up rather strongly for three consecutive days and took a little breather in here today. This represents the bounce from oversold conditions from the region of the lows we saw back in January and October. Now the question is, how much further could it go? The reality here is that there's still a lot of uncertainty, but there's been a fair amount of bad news priced in, with a 5,000 point decline over the course of a few months. I should note that there's a bit of banging going on behind me, and I'm having the roof replaced in my home, and that was due to be complete while I was away, but it hasn't been completed. When we look at the oversold condition, well, there is scope for a reversionary rally, but there's still the sequence of lower rally highs, and then there's still the uncertainty about how the relationship between the Hong Kong protesters and the central government in Beijing is going to play out. And then you have the slowdown in China as well. I do intend to write a trip review of my time in both China and Taiwan tomorrow. I'm giving it a day to let my thoughts percolate a little bit. But there is evidence of a slowdown in China. I think that there's plenty of evidence of that. That suggests that there is ample scope for some additional stimulus to come through. And the A-share market has pushed back above the trend mean, and it's been in positive territory as well over the course of the last three consecutive days. The renminbi, however, has continued to remain weak, and it is pushing its lows in here today. So I think it is really quite unlikely we're going to see the renminbi strengthen through 7 anytime soon, and there is significant scope for it to weaken further. China needs a weak currency. Everyone else does too, however, but I think China and Europe probably need weak currencies more than anyone else. We did see a rather positive move today in Australia. The market was up about 1%. That bucked the trend for markets generally. It was one of the better performing internationally. It's demonstrating some support in the region of the peak from 2018, and it's unwound about two-thirds of its overextension relative to the trend mean. This is a potential area for some support to come through, but I think in order for a really strong bullish turn of sentiment, it's going to have to sustain a move back above the 6600 level, and there is still the rest of that overextension relative to the trend mean to be unwound. New Zealand, on the other hand, remains one of the best performing and most consistent advances in the world over the course of the last 7 years, and that pickup in the pace of the advance this year remains very much in form. A sustained move below the 10,500 level would really be required to question the consistency of the overall trend. Then when we look at the rest of Asia, the Thai market was weaker in here today and encountering resistance in the region of the trend mean. When we then think about what's going on in South Korea, that had been one of the markets that has demonstrated the effects of the slowdown in global growth from the beginning of 2018. It's oversold in the short term, so there is scope for a rebound in here, but it does have work to do in order to really confirm that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. When then we think about what's going on in Europe, well, it looks like the Italian administration is going to be dissolved. And the question is whether a new coalition can be created without an election. That remains very much open to question. European markets were in negative territory in here today, and the FTSE 100 has encountered resistance in the region of the trend mean. It really does need to demonstrate a return to demand dominance by holding the 7,000 level. 7,000 has been an area of resistance in the past, and when we look at the longer term trend, it by and large represents the upper side of the range that persisted between 2000 and 2016. So it would be a convenient level for for support to be found in order to demonstrate that this is still a first step above the mean, or a first step above the long-term base. I saw this chart earlier on today, and I thought it was particularly interesting because it gives us the spread in basis points between 10-year treasuries and dividend aristocrats. I'm highlighting it now because the FTSE 100 is packed full of globally significant, internationally oriented companies that are either have autonomy characteristics or are among the longest running members of the European S&P 350 Europe Dividend Aristocrats Index. 100 basis points is about as wide a spread as we've seen in the course of the last 7 years, and the last time it has been this wide was back in 2016. Well, then I thought it would be interesting to look at the actual trend, and it remains up and really quite consistent. Of course, this is a total return index, so it does include the dividend, but the dividends on Dividend Aristocrat shares don't tend to be particularly high because they tend to get bid up, and that keeps the yield under, or generally keeps the yield rather competitive relative to the treasury yield. When it's at 100 basis points, it does, I think, help to suggest that we have got ample scope for that yield to compress further on these Dividend Aristocrat shares. Well, the FTSE 100 is one proxy. Consumer staples is another for the Dividend Aristocrats. And consumer staples continues to hold the breakout from the 3-year range. When we then think about how has the autonomies fund been doing, I don't generally like to talk about the performance of the fund I manage, but it has broken out and it is continuing to advance. It's benefiting from the compression of yields internationally. Well, this total of the quantity of negative yields remains a very significant factor. It's an additional consideration in the compression of the US 10-year yield. When we think about the fact that it's down to 1.5%, I don't think that would have been possible if it weren't for the fact that we have over $16 trillion dollars worth of bonds with negative yields in Europe and Japan. This has been a very swift pullback, and particularly relative to the fact that it took almost 2.5 years for the yield to run up from 1.5% to 3.25%. It's taken less than a year for it to compress again. This compression in yields is similar to the compression and the speed of the compression that we saw in 2011. And that was a very meaningful move. Now, when we look at this on a long-term basis, it has been tempting to think that this was a base formation for the 10-year yield. But we're right in the lower side of this range, and the relative value play is to buy these bonds at these levels because of the fact that you still get a positive return. And That doesn't necessarily mean that it's a particularly great value, but when you have negative yielding bonds with such enormous quantities all over the world, then there is a clear necessity for pension funds to try and buy bonds that have got a positive yield, because it's the only way they can create a laddering effect and manage their long-term liabilities. When we think about the effect this is having internationally, well, when we have this compression in yields that has got incredible commonality all over the world, and an increasing number of central banks that are ready to cut interest rates aggressively, then on the one hand, it's tempting to conclude that that is pricing in a sharply deflationary environment. That's potentially the case in Germany, it's or in and in Europe generally. Japan has been battling a deflationary outcome for a significant period of time. China's economy is slowing down. The trade war is being priced in, and US consumers appear to be holding up the entire global economy at this stage. And the US consumer remains in robust shape. But this is also suggestive that we are in a bubbly environment where there is no longer a clear rationale for value, but rather a almost a forcible factor behind the momentum move. It is this fear of missing out, this fear that if you do not invest now, you're going to have a significant problem later, is propelling this incredible compression in yields. There are companies that are benefiting enormously from it. The IPO of WeWork is going to be a very significant event. This is a company that is likely to have a valuation in the order of $40 billion with on revenue of 400 million, and it is losing twice as much money as it's making on an annual basis. The only possible way you could make a rationale for a company like this to exist is because we are in an environment with limitless free money, and that's an incredible scenario. It's very reminiscent of the kind of valuations and the logic behind the valuations that we had in the 1990s. Except that on this occasion, it isn't necessarily that we have the growth argument, but rather the deflation argument that is driving it. Nonetheless, it's still bubbly in terms of the action that we're seeing. This bubble in bonds is profoundly larger than the bubble that we had in equities in the 1990s. I think that fact alone is something that a lot of people don't really have a great deal of appreciation for. Now, when we look at gold, well, there's a reason why Mark Mobius was saying in here today, or quoted in here today, that gold is a buy at any level around this time, because the likelihood of central bank printing is going to make that a rational decision. Gold prices continue to rally, or to pause at least, around the $1,500 area. This pause is really very similar in amplitude to the one that we saw between June and July. As long as that remains the case, we can conclude that this is just another step in an otherwise bull market environment. This move to negative yields has been a very significant catalyst for gold prices. We have to remember that gold is volatile, that it does not always trend in this as consistent a manner, and that it is prone to significant pullbacks. So the trend mean is currently at $1,327, and the price is at $1,507. So $190 in terms of the overextension is significant. Pullbacks of that magnitude in a bull market for precious metals generally offer the best entry opportunities. it is generally the best time is to buy is following those occasional pullbacks. Considering the outlook for central bank printing, then there are likely to be times when we do get run-ups in the yield, and that will likely compress the overextensions we see in the precious metal markets. But considering the momentum move we still have in bonds, then that is contributing to the momentum move we're still seeing in the precious metal markets. Then it's also worth highlighting that when we think about the outlook for the precious metal mining sector, the range that is forming right now on the gold miners ETF is quite similar to that which formed in late July. We have a sequence of ranges, one above another, and the price just found support in the region of the upper side of the most recent underlying range. This is still a very consistent advance. It really does help to support the view that we are going to see gold miners complete their 6-year base formation in the not so distant future, and that is going to be a very significant development. One of the key attributes for gold miners is that they are cheap relative to their peak values. There simply aren't that many sectors that are still within base formations after an already 10-year long bull market environment. What I thought was worth highlighting as well is this chart of the outlook for gold mine production between 2014 and 2024. Obviously, any prognostication beyond 2020 doesn't make a lot of sense, considering that this came out back in April. Prices have run up significantly since then. It completely changes the economic rationale for investing in additional new supply. What it does suggest is that we are going to continue to see mine production expand into the next few years and potentially beyond. The higher gold prices go, the greater the economic sense it's going to make to invest in new supply. But one of the clearest changes we've seen in gold mining has been the massive step up we've seen in the marginal cost of production. Before the bull market started back in the early 2000s, there was plenty of supply that was economic in the order of about $200 an ounce. Today, the vast majority of new supply becomes economic around the $950 an ounce level. There are established miners that have got all-in sustaining costs in the region of between $750 and $900, but the new supply coming on board is sometimes in the order of about $1,100. Well, that's still profitable at $1,500 an ounce. We're going to start to see more supply coming online. The time when gold miners outperform is in the early part of the cycle, before they take on additional debt loads in ambitious expansion plans. That is the catalyst for underperformance that we need to be particularly aware of. Before that, it's quite likely that these gold miners are going to continue to outperform. What I also found interesting in here today is that cobalt prices having collapsed following the peak that we saw back in 2018 are finding support. Glencore has said that they're going to limit supply in order to rebalance the market, and that would suggest that we have seen the lows in cobalt prices. Against a background where nickel prices are still outperforming and clearly have a bull market hypothesis behind them in terms of demand for batteries, then that is I think, a rather significant factor as well. Of course, cobalt is also a byproduct of nickel mining as well as copper mining. So the more nickel that is produced, the more cobalt that will be produced as well. demand for nickel sulfide, which is purer than the delivery conditions for LME nickel, is likely to continue to trend higher as demand growth for batteries continues, and not least because just about every one of the automotive companies have got plans for a lot more electric vehicles to hit the market as soon as next year. Then what I also found interesting today was the change we've seen in the outlook for lead. It has now pushed back above the trend mean. This has been a very choppy environment over the course of the last decade. And what I think is rather interesting is that this range has persisted for such a long time and has been so very volatile that a change to that volatility could easily see the price take out the peak from back in 2007. If it can break the sequence of lower rally highs, so not only sustain the move above the 2000 level, but break that sequence, then at least a retest of the upper side of the range would look more likely. The fact that we're starting to see some interest come back into the industrial metals is suggestive that we are approaching a trough in global growth, that the outlook for the metals and the outlook for massive monetary and fiscal accommodation from just about every government in the world is likely to have an effect on the global economy. What is, I think, a continued source of caution is the outlook for the banking sector. Banks in the US today were in negative territory. They were in positive territory in Europe, but not by an awful lot. And the rationale for owning banks in a negative yielding environment is rather, I think, a troubled environment where they just aren't going to be able to make money without significant assistance. The underperformance of banks has generally been a lead indicator for problems in the wider market. That does suggest that we are in the bubble phase, that the compression of yields, the return of demand for the dividend aristocrat type companies, the continued outperformance of the technology sector led by the FANGs, that is representative of a narrowing of focus. The continued benefit that some of the companies that have adopted subscription business models in the technology sector, so that they are hybrids between that growth from the technology sector and the reliability of cash flows from the consumer staples sector, that's also representative of narrowing of breadth. And the underperformance of banks, the fact that the Russell 2000 index is still in negative territory and now pausing below the trend mean, the fact that the transportation index has also been weakening. This is not particularly supportive of the view that we are at the trough in global growth. What it does suggest is that we are not yet at the trough in U.S. growth, whereas we may be at the trough in global growth. That's a potential differentiator. What we have to bear in mind is that this incredible bubble in bonds is affecting the valuations of everything. And when the bubble eventually bursts, it is going to have a significant impact on the valuation of just about everything. In the meantime, the momentum in the bond markets is still very much intact. We are still at the point where the likelihood of a bubble in equities is, I think, the base case and has not yet occurred, and continues to represent the hedge that has got room to perform additionally and is the new momentum trade that is, I think, just starting to get going. And I think with that, I will leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.